The final case for oral argument this morning is Clara Stephenson et al. And Andrea Brown and Gerald Hayne appellants, B. Tamara Luke et al. Appellee. If I understand it correctly, Mr. Glenn Roth will go first for 15 minutes, is that correct?
That's correct.
And then Mr. Kenneth Catton will go for 5 minutes?
That's correct.
All right, and then for the appellees, we have Mr. Thomas Alberts will go for 10 minutes?
Yes, Your Honor. Chris Brady has his hand first.
Okay, well, we can do that. All right, and then Mr. Catton and Mr. Roth will split the 10-minute rebuttal, correct? And Mr. Roth, you'll go first. All right. All right, Mr. Roth, you may proceed, sir, and you have 15 minutes.
Please, the court, counsel, clerks. Your Honors, the issue is whether Gerard Hayne, as a secondary beneficiary under the trust, should be entitled to receive a distribution equal to the amount that the other secondary beneficiaries received during the lifetime of Clara Stephenson, the wife of Elmer Stephenson. For your information, Your Honors, during the lifetime of Clara Stephenson, the trustee, Tamara Luke, not the original trustee, but the trustee that came aboard after the trust was established by Elmer Stephenson, distributed to herself $80,000, and to her grandchildren, or rather her children, $45,000. I'm rounding off, $47,000 each, and to Gerard Hayne, $500. Since the court supervision on July 24, 2001. Now, the pertinent articles of the trust is Article 1, Article 4, Paragraphs 3 through 5, Article 5, Article 6, Paragraphs 1 and 2. That is the flow that we have, and that is what the testator, in this case, the settlor, intended. If you look at Article 1, it clearly states that the secondary beneficiaries are the son-in-law, the granddaughter, and the great-grandchildren. Now, this family is a small family, three generations. We have the son-in-law, his wife is Carmen, she predeceased Elmer and Clara, and the son-in-law was the only generation after Elmer and Clara. Then one grandchild, and then the three named great-grandchildren under the trust. In Article 1, Elmer said, it's my grandson, or my son-in-law, my granddaughter, my great-grandchildren. He specifically delineated that is his family. Now, if you turn to Article 4, Paragraphs 3, under Article 4, the second part, it says, the beneficiaries herein shall receive as much of the principal of the trust as the trustees deem necessary and advisable for their education, health, maintenance, and support. The trustee, and in this case, it was Elmer's son-in-law, Gerard Hayne. He trusted him. He thought he was going to be the trustee throughout. Gave specific instructions that the trustee shall receive the principal from the trust. The paragraph 4 of Article 4, the trustee shall be mindful that the settlor's primary concern and not the objective is to provide for the welfare of the designated beneficiaries. The beneficiaries designated are the secondary beneficiaries in Article 1. He gave his son-in-law, Elmer gave his son-in-law Gerard, the discretion to give as much income that he believed would be necessary for himself, his granddaughter, and the great-grandchildren. Keeping in mind what other resources those beneficiaries would have. Paragraph five, it says, after the death of my spouse, the trustee shall, to the greatest extent possible, equalize the distributions to the beneficiaries. Not to the grandchild or the great-grandchildren, but to the beneficiaries. And then it goes on to say, any distribution to or for a beneficiary shall be charged against the ultimate share distributable to such beneficiary, or to those taking through such beneficiary upon termination of the trust.
Now, I have a question on that, what you just read there. Because when you talk about ultimate share, your client really doesn't get an ultimate share.
That is correct.
So how does that square with your interpretation of this paragraph?
Justice Meyer Henry, if I will concede that one sentence is why we're here today. But if Elmer Stevenson wanted to equalize the distributions only among the granddaughter and the great-grandchildren, then he would have included that under Article 6, second paragraph. That is where he would have included that. What he said in that first sentence, Justice Meyer Henry, is after the death of my spouse. Not after the death of Gerard Hain, but after the death of my spouse.
But after the death of the spouse, my understanding is Gerard gets a life estate. He has income for half of it. Life estate on half of it, correct?
That is correct.
So at that point, he has whatever distribution he's really ever going to get. Isn't that right?
That is correct. I understand. Your Honors, we all drafted wills in our careers, trusts and wills in our careers. And what we do is when our clients come in, they say, I want to make sure my wife is taken care of, and then my children, and if so, then my grandchildren. Now, what's inconceivable here is this. Elmer Stevenson died in September 15th of 1992. He made this trust on August 8th, 1990. Clara Stevenson died on December 27, 2003. 11 years had passed. Now, it's inconceivable that Elmer Stevenson, and again, we got to equate Gerard Hain and Carmen together, because that's the one and only generation, the one person out of that generation. That was her husband. He wants to provide for him. And it's inconceivable that there was not going to be any income, or rather any distribution to Gerard Hain from the date of his death until Clara Stevenson died. That's 11 years. And then all of a sudden, he gets half the income for the rest of his life. We also got to be mindful of the fact there was 1,515 acres of land at the time that this trust was created. That was 1,550 acres at $60 an acre back then in 1990. That's a lot of money. That's almost $90,000 or more than that.
Now, was some of that, had they sold some of that off then by the time Clara died?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. They had sold off approximately 400 acres, I believe.
Okay.
That's been the supervision of the trust. Mm-hmm. And there was other assets before the supervision of the trust, I understand.
Well, you still haven't answered Justice Meyer Henry's question to my satisfaction. That is, how could Gerard get anything when it so clearly says shall be charged against the ultimate share? The equalizing distribution shall be charged.
As I tried to indicate before, that if Elmer Stevenson wanted it to only be charged against the ultimate share after the death of Gerard Hain, then it would have been inserted in paragraph or article 6, and probably just in the same paragraph upon the death of Gerard Hain. Then the trustee shall true up or equalize the shares that were previously advanced to the beneficiaries during the lifetime of my wife. That is where the appropriate place should be. I will point out, Justices, that throughout Article 4, Elmer Stevenson uses the words "the designated beneficiaries," "the beneficiaries." Under Article 6, he states "the remaining beneficiaries." The remaining beneficiaries. That's a quite important distinction because he is again including his son-in-law to receive an equal distribution upon the death of Clara Stevenson. Whatever distributions were made during her lifetime, that was when he should have received his distribution just like the rest. Elmer Stevenson wanted his son-in-law to participate in that distribution. In summary, Justices, I ask you again to follow the flow. You read Article 1, couple that with Article 4, 3, 4, and 5 paragraphs, Article 5, and then Article 6. If you flow through that, you will see that that was Elmer's intent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roth. Mr. Cotton, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel, Clerks, ladies and gentlemen. Before I get started here this morning, I'd like to just point out one discrepancy in the findings of fact and conclusions of law that were originally entered and as they apply to the death of Elmer Stevenson. If you turn to page 2 of the findings of fact and conclusions of law entered by Judge McMurtry on April 2nd of 2004, you'll see where the date of death at finding number 3 for Elmer Stevenson states that Elmer Stevenson died in 1991. And during the process of putting the arguments together here this morning, not only myself but other counsel involved in this matter, and I think everybody would agree that in my objections that I filed on behalf of Andrea Brown to the proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law at item number 1, we have the correct date of Elmer Stevenson's death reflected, which is September 15th, 1992. So we just wanted to bring that to your attention. I think Mr. Braley will have more to say about that in his argument.
As another point, background point, when Judge Stappe ruled that afterborn children were not to be included, why was that not reduced to an order that would be part of the law of the case?
Justice Savers, I can't answer that. I don't know. At that time, Judge Tappy was experiencing some health problems and it just never got done. It was not rendered down to an order. At that point in time, I think all of us involved in this case knew that at some point in time there'd be this declaratory judgment action coming up to talk about many issues in this case. The issue between Andre and Angela being one of them, and that's why we're here today.
Which party's obligation would it be under what Judge Tappy had to say that day at the end of the hearing?
It would be presumably either Mr. Alberts or myself would have been our obligation. And quite frankly, I thought that order had been done until we got into the briefing process in this case.
All right, go ahead with your argument.
Okay, thank you. The sole issue that I'm here on this morning is the appeal in file number 23-285, and that issue is whether or not Angela Brown, who is Mr. Braley's client, should be included under the terms and conditions of the Elmer Stevenson Trust as a beneficiary. And it's Andrea's position that she should not be included as a beneficiary under the trust. If you look at Article 1 of the trust, the trustor is very clear in stating that the secondary beneficiaries of the Elmer Stevenson Trust are my son-in-law, Gerard Hain, my granddaughter, Tamara K. Brown, and my minor great-grandchildren, namely Jennifer Sampson, Jason Sampson, and Andrea Brown. Those are the only individuals that are listed at that point in the trust.
Isn't there a rule of construction that when you say grandchildren, or great-grandchildren in this case, I guess, wouldn't it be? Yes. That you include everybody in that, even though you name only those that are living at that time?
Well, Justice Myra Henry, the rule of construction is something that certainly I believe exists.
But I think in this particular case, where the settlor is so specific as to which grandchildren he names, and keep in mind, that's where I think that the death date of Elmer Stevenson becomes important. Angela was born in 1991, so Elmer certainly had time, were he of a mind to change the trust agreement so that Angela would have been included, and for whatever reason, he didn't do that.
Does that make it ambiguous, then, to bring in his intent through other evidence?
I think that it does. I believe that the mere fact of Judge Tappy coming to a different conclusion than Judge McMurtry shows that there's some ambiguity in this trust agreement. Matter of fact, if you read through the whole trust agreement, there's many, many areas of ambiguity, and that's why we're here today. And if the trust document is ambiguous, then obviously you can bring in outside testimony, such as Alice Rokar's testimony, which I've submitted with my brief, and also Clara Stevenson's testimony, which I've submitted with my brief. And just in closing, real quickly, I wanted to remind the court, and I'm sure I don't need to do that, but I would like to remind the court of its decision in the estate of Edna Jane Howe case, specifically at page 33, where this court indicated that further, while not a part of the wrongful death statutory scheme, the legislature has defined child in the UPC as excluding a person who is only a grandchild. And here we're talking about great-grandchildren, so we're one generation removed.
Your time has expired, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Braley, you have 10 minutes.
Excuse me. May it please the court? Counsel. Good morning. I am the court-appointed guardian ad litem. My name is Chris Braley. I'm court-appointed guardian ad litem to Angela Brown. And the first thing I would like to clarify is that I agree with Mr. Cotton's assessment of the factuals, the facts in this case, in that Elmer Stevenson died on September 15, 1992, and then my client was born in 1991. And I would also like the court to understand that from the time that I was appointed through trial and through the process of the briefing and preparing for this oral argument, that's always been my understanding that she was alive prior to his death. With that said,
Mr. Braley, let me interrupt because yes. Your time is short. Would you respond to Mr. Cotton's last argument first, the thing about the UPC definition?
Yes, Your Honor.
Of children, I should say.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor. I would submit to the court that would be the weakest point of my case. Would be the definition of child under the UPC, then in addition to your application of that in the estate of Howe case. However, I think that this court has made it clear in a previous time, this is not the first time this trust has been in front of the court. I believe it was in 2000, a different issue came up on appeal. And I would submit to the court that in the matter of the state of Elmer Stevenson, the first, I guess, and kind of roundabout answer your question, but I believe that the first issue is whether it's ambiguous or not, and we take the position that it's not ambiguous. Therefore, if it's not ambiguous, the court held in the state of Elmer Stevenson that we must interpret the instrument as written, and if that intention is clearly manifested by the language of the trust instrument, is the duty of this court to declare and enforce it. I believe that this language, the trust, Article 1, is not ambiguous, and that based on that, the intentions of the trustor would take precedence over what the UPC, the writers of UPC, put in the definition of child. I would submit to the court that if it was his intention, if the court finds this is unambiguous and it was his intention to include afterborn great-grandchild, that it is the duty of this court then to declare and enforce it. To do so would go against a prior ruling that this court has made. And basically that's our position on that, and I believe that I've answered it. Stepping back, Actually, I want to add one further thing to that, Your Honor. In reviewing the Uniform Probate Code, let's look at the general intent. If you look at the omitted child statute, the anti-lap statute, in addition to the intestate succession, the general intent of the Uniform Probate Code is to keep assets through trust or through probate within the bloodline. In addition, the intestate succession treats those children, great-grandchildren, nephews, nieces, equally. Therefore, I think a strict reading of the definition of child flows in contrast to what the UPC in general does. The first step that this court has set out when determining the intentions of a document, including a trust, is whether it's ambiguous or not. I believe that the trial court was correct in determining that it was not ambiguous, in that in Article 1, the trustor specifically stated that he wanted his son-in-law, his granddaughter, and three great-grandchildren who were living at the time the trust was drawn up. By naming those three great-grandchildren, I believe the court, trial court, correctly did not close the class, that he set a class and that his intentions then were to include every great-grandchild who was born at the time prior to the trust being written and at the time after, anybody who was born thereafter.
Yeah, but he knew, based on the testimony, about which there might also be other ambiguities, he knew prior to his death, and I think there was some testimony that he discussed it with Clara, and yet he never did anything about his trust, did he? He didn't ever specifically name your client.
No.
In that trust.
And I would agree with that. However, Your Honor, I believe under South Dakota law, and specifically SDCL 55-3-26, and I paraphrase, take some language out that doesn't really apply, that the court may modify the administration or dispositive terms of the trust, and this is where I take the language out and start up with, because of circumstances not anticipated by the trustor. If the court finds that it's ambiguous, I believe that the circuit court could take that outside testimony and apply it to this statute and apply it to the trust, and the trustee has the ability to modify those dispositive terms. I think the facts, and I would, if the court was to go that it was, and I disagree, I believe it's not ambiguous, but if the court finds it's ambiguous, I would request that you review all the testimony of Clara Stevenson, in which she indicates that at the time from the time that this Angela was born, my client was born, until the time of his death, that he did have this conversation, that he did want her in. However, because of health problems, I believe it was two heart attacks and a stroke, he was unable to do that. And he, as trustor and as trustee, did not have the physical ability to do that. But he indicated that to Clara, his wife. And I would say that this section could be applied to allow that his wishes could be carried forward by the new trustee.
His unaffected wishes would be enforced.
I would submit that could be true. However, I believe that in the testimony of Clara, all parties involved had the opportunity to cross-examine her, and basically her story stuck. That's what Elmer wanted. I believe that's true.
Isn't the final line is that he knew she was born, he knew that he had not named her, maybe he wished he had, but anyway, or that he desired to, but that he never got it done.
I would agree with that. That's the fact scenario that we need to deal with. But jumping back a step, I don't believe that it's ambiguous that he at first never needed to do anything with the trust, because Article 1 is clear as to the intentions of what he wanted to do By naming the specific great-grandchildren doesn't close the class, and I would submit to the court that at the time that trust was drawn up, he couldn't have named her because she wasn't born yet. So I don't know if I answered your question, but I would submit to the court that that is a factual problem that my client has, and I guess we just have to deal with that. In regards to Judge Tappy's hearing, I was court-appointed originally by Judge Tappy and had the hearing in which he allowed the extrinsic evidence in. Mr. Cotton has argued res judicata. I believe that res judicata does not apply. The Supreme Court has set out a four-prong test on when res judicata applies, and I feel that this case fails, Judge Tappy's hearing fails on two of those. Prong two, whether there was a final judgment on the merits. As was stated earlier by Mr. Cotton, there was no order and there was no findings of fact in which I had the ability on behalf of my client to appeal that to the Supreme Court. In addition, whether there was a full and fair opportunity to litigate issues in the prior adjudication, I would fall back on that we never had the opportunity to appeal that decision. With that said, I verily believe that my client should be included in the trust based on the my brief and based on this oral argument. And I guess I would take this opportunity to thank you for giving me the opportunity to argue on her behalf. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Braley. Mr. Alberts, you have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel, clerks, I'm appearing on behalf of the trustee to argue the position that Gerard Hain should be only included as a life tenant and receive only the one undivided one half of the rents, issues, and profits, and that he should not be included in any of the disbursements of the corpus trust, the corpus itself. My client, as the trustee, is charged with the day-to-day actual implementation of the trust provisions. And after Clara, well, prior to Clara Stevenson's death, I think the trust document is very clear that Clara Stevenson is entitled to, or was entitled to, all of the income from the trust. And she got that. What she did with it after that, obviously, was outside the purview of the trust document itself and was never controlled by the trust document. But she did, in fact, get all of the trust income. After her death, and I should go back, in addition to that, prior to Clara Stevenson's death, some of the corpus of the trust was converted from land to cash. That cash was distributed to beneficiaries, meaning the ultimate beneficiaries, as Justice Meyer Henry pointed out. The ultimate beneficiaries in this particular trust, it's clear in the document itself, are granddaughter, Tamara Luke, who's the trustee, and her children, which would be the great-grandchildren of Elmer Stevenson, the trustor. The great-grandchildren are at least the three named in the trust. And the argument that Mr. Braley is making to this court here today is that the fourth grandchildren, great-grandchild, should also be included in that class of great-grandchildren. So prior to the death of Clara Stevenson and Mr. Cotton or Mr. Roth, I forget which one answered, is accurate in that there were approximately three-quarters or a little more of the ground that formed the corpus of the trust sold, converted to cash, and distributed to ultimate beneficiaries who did not include, or that class, or that terminology, did not include Gerard Hain. It never, he didn't get anything. He didn't object to it. He had an opportunity to, but he didn't object to it either. So then in 2001, when the day-to-day administration of the trust became more difficult to do, a petition was made for a court-supervised trust in accordance with the statute, which was done. And after the order was entered for the court supervising the trust, meaning the circuit court, an additional amount of land, I believe it was one tract of one quarter, was also sold, and same type of distribution to ultimate beneficiaries and not to Gerard Hain. So, and that brings us up to the death of Clara Stevenson. So on the day that Clara Stevenson died, there was a division of the monies that remained in the trust at that time, and I think it's like $100,000 roughly, and a division of the income that was going to be earned from those trust, from that trust corpus. From and after the day Clara Stevenson died, one half of the trust income goes directly to Gerard Hain, and one half gets divided among grandchild, who is Tamara Luke, and her children. That one half gets divided one half to Tamara Luke, and one half among, well, right now, four grandchildren, and depending upon the ruling of this court, three or four. If Mr. Braley's client is included in the class as designated by the trust, that's how it'll be done. But under no circumstances, the trustee is of the position, under no circumstances should Gerard Hain and Mr. Roth and his argument say that he somehow gets the benefit of any of the corpus of the trust, because it's clear from the trust document, it's not ambiguous at all, that the ultimate equalizing of the trust relates to the ultimate beneficiaries. That would be grandchild and great-grandchildren, whether it be three or four, and never includes Gerard Hain. Under no possible set of facts in this declaratory judgment action could Gerard Hain ever come in and get part of the corpus of the trust. He's only entitled to one half of the income therefrom. Since the last piece of ground has been sold, obviously, and in accordance with Judge McMurtry's ruling, he's determined that the corpus cannot be invaded. So the land sits there. The land earns income from it. Income from that pays real estate taxes, fiduciary income tax, and then the trust distributes one half to Gerard and one half to the other beneficiaries. So that's the day-to-day operation of the trust as it exists today.
So it's basically the land then, any cash, is there cash still?
Yes, Justice Meyer Henry, there's the land of about 960 acres, and there's cash in what we call Trust A and Trust B as of Clara Stevenson's death, in accordance with the ruling of the trial court. Trust A would be half of the cash that was there, Trust B would be the other half of the cash there. We've got about, I looked the other day, 70,000 here and maybe 50,000 here. And what is done with the cash here in both Trust A and Trust B is that the earnings from the cash in Trust B, which is Gerard Hain, gets distributed to him. The earnings from the cash in Trust A gets distributed to grandchild and great-grandchildren. And in addition to that, we have continuing issues from Clara's death regarding unpaid expenses that is not part of this appeal, but does deal with the day-to-day operations of the trust by the trustee. And we appear in front of the trial court and say, Judge McMurtry, there's this bill, and this bill. Should it be paid equally from Trust A cash and Trust B cash? And some we pay equally, and some each is responsible for. So that's how we do it on a day-to-day basis. But under no set of circumstances has it ever been determined that Gerard Hain gets anything except what he's entitled to. That's his half of the income, from whether it's interest income from his Trust B or income from the rental of the land. And that's what we've done since Clara's death. That's what the trustee has done since Clara's death. That's what the trustee has done last week. And trustee has done that in accordance with Judge McMurtry's ruling, and basically in accordance with the provisions of the trust. And trustee would argue that at least regarding the issue of distribution of corpus, that's not ambiguous, it's clear in the trust,
and Gerard Hayne, under no set of circumstances, can come in and get any portion or part of that. That would be trustee's position. And that's trustee's interest, obviously, in the ultimate decision of this court is so that she can do what's right in accordance with the trust provisions on a day-to-day basis, albeit there are a couple of issues. Those issues have been handled on a day-to-day basis because Mr. Braley's client, or Mr. Braley on behalf of his client, all that money has been segregated so that irregardless of whatever the ruling of this court is, that, that'll be reconciled and can be, and can be reconciled for the rest of the beneficiaries if that is required.
How do you respond to the argument that if you follow through Articles 1, 3, 4, 5, and 6, that shows an intent that Gerard does receive?
Your Honor, trustee would totally disagree with that. I believe that's convoluted logic. I don't believe that's what the trust says at all. The trust may contain those words. However, you go back to the final provision of the sentence that says the ultimate beneficiaries equalize. And I don't believe any of that terminology that Mr. Roth argued, in no disrespect to Mr. Roth, but I don't believe it comes to the conclusion that he arrives at. It may or could have been more clear, but it's not. And that's probably the best posture he can put on the argument, but it still doesn't cut the last sentence of the line where it says to equalize. And in conclusion, I would agree with Mr. Cotton that with regard to the order of the hearing in 2001, wherever it was, I had equal responsibility to have that order drawn, not just Mr. Cotton. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alberts. All right, Mr. Roth, you have 5 minutes.
Your Honors, it is true that the trustee distributed that money to the ultimate distribution, to the ultimate beneficiaries. And in Mr. Haynes' affidavit, which is attached to the motion of reconsideration, he gives his reasons why it happened that way. I want to get back to the duty that was placed on the trustee in Article 4. It says that the duty of the trustee shall equalize the ultimate distributions, shall equalize the distributions that were made during Clara Stevens's lifetime. The reason why it was put in there, Your Honors, is because Elmer Stevenson said it's my beneficiaries. He was consistent in paragraph throughout saying my beneficiaries. Had Mr. Stevenson, Elmer Stevenson, wanted it to just be the equalization to have taken place, it would have been placed in Article 6. It should have said, upon the death of Gerard Hayne, my trustee shall then equalize those distributions. Again, I stress the fact that in this case, throughout his trust, my beneficiaries equal secondary beneficiaries. And Article 4 is where the duty was placed on the trustee to distribute that, to make equalized distributions to all the beneficiaries, that being the secondary beneficiaries, including Gerard Hayne. If Elmer Stevenson wanted Gerard to only be a life tenant, he would have simply put in his trust under Article 1 that my secondary beneficiaries are my granddaughter and my three great-grandchildren, and Gerard Hayne is a life tenant under Article 6 of this my trust. He could have done it. He didn't do it. He put it under Article 4 to flow consistently. Again, I stress the fact that Elmer Stevenson wanted to provide for his son-in-law, who was named the only co-trustee and the only successor trustee. He never envisioned his granddaughter, Tamara Luke, to be the trustee of his trust. And if you look at the footnote in Stevenson 1, if you look at the footnote in Stevenson 1, Gerard Hayne resigned within 1 month of Elmer Stevenson's death. Tamara Luke took over, ultimately. And again, Elmer wanted his son-in-law to be protected, just as He wanted his daughter, if she was living, to receive income during those 11 years, or rather a distribution during those 11 years that his wife, Clara, was living. And we asked the court to read those in conjunction with each other.
Does the fact that your client gave up the trustee position to Tamara Boop because of some kind of conflict, does that have any effect on any of the issues in the case?
I believe Justice Saber does. If Gerard Hayne would have continued to be the trustee, he would have been fair, just as Article says, as Elmer wanted it to in Article 4. He wanted to be fair to everybody, including himself. Gerard Hayne...
But why did he give it up then? I mean...
Because of, in his affidavit, it was the pressures of Clara Stevenson and Tamara Luke, his daughter. He was under so much pressure, he gave it up. He threw it up. And as if you look at our footnote, the footnote in Stevenson 1, you will notice that Tamara Luke, after a series of trustees, after Gerard resigned, within 1 month of Elmer's death, there was a series of trustees, and ultimately Tamara Luke, the granddaughter, became the trustee. It was the pressures and the influences on by Clara Stevenson and Tamara Luke. And again, had Gerard Hayne been involved in that trust, he would have made sure that everybody was going to be equalized as Article 4 requests. Elmer wanted to be fair to his family, which included his one and only son-in-law. I want to thank you, Justices, for giving me the time to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Roth. Mr. Cotton, I guess you close.
Thank you, Justices. In closing, I'd just like to raise a couple of points. Number one, going back to the case involving the Edna Howe estate and the comments that Mr. Braley made in regard to that particular case. The language, I think, is quite, if in fact that you believe that the trust is controlled by the UPC, then that's the language that we would certainly use. And if, as this court previously stated in the estate of Edna Howe case, that, and I'm quoting now from page 33, further, while not a part of the wrongful death statutory scheme, the legislature has defined child in the UPC as excluding, quote, a person who is only a grandchild. And as I mentioned in my previous argument, we're talking about great-grandchildren in this particular case. So I think that Mr. Braley's efforts to distinguish the Howe case from this particular case, if in fact the court believes that the UPC is the law that we would apply to this particular situation, then clearly Angela should not be included because she's not mentioned in the trust. If in fact the court believes that the UPC is not the appropriate law to be applied, that if we consider that the trust was executed in, I believe, August of 1990, and that Elmer Stevenson died in September of 1992, and that Elmer Stevenson's estate was opened in April of 1994, all of those dates being prior to the adoption, or actually the implementation of the UPC, which I believe became effective in South Dakota on July 1st of 1995, if we believe that we apply the law that was in place at that point in time, which seems reasonable to me, then we have to look at the trust document and determine whether or not it's ambiguous. And if you look at that trust document, at Article 1, we have specific naming of Tamara Luke and her three children, the minor great-grandchildren, Jennifer, Jason, and Andrea. We don't see Angela in there. And if you go to Article 5, Article 6, in the third full paragraph, they talk about, the second paragraph, they talk about upon the death of Gerald Hayne, the trust is then to be distributed according to the terms set forth below for the distribution to Tamara K. Brown and her children. They don't name any specific children at that point. But then in the very next paragraph, They say, at the time that the youngest of Jennifer, Jason, or Andrea reached the age of 21 years, then that's a triggering event for the ultimate distribution of the trust. And then down below, when they talk about how the ultimate distribution is going to go, 25% of the last 50% goes to Tammy, and the other 25%, there again, they talk about being divided equally between Jennifer, Jason, and Andrea. Angela's not mentioned. And certainly in that case, I think that the court would have to admit that as to this issue anyway, the trust document is ambiguous. If the trust document is ambiguous, then we allow outside evidence to come in, i.e. the testimony of Alice Rokar and Clara Stevenson. And I think if the court considers and reviews that testimony, which was introduced at the declaratory judgment trial in May of 2001, all counsel were present. It came in without objection, and it's part of the record in this particular matter. If, in fact, the court finds that we're applying the old law and that the trust is ambiguous, which I certainly think it is, then if you look to that evidence, it's clear that Elmer Stevenson's intention was to not include Angela. It's also clear that Angela was born prior to Elmer's death. It's also clear that Elmer could have changed the trust instrument had he wanted to include Angela, and for whatever reason, he didn't do it. And consequently, it's the view of Andrea that Angela should not be included in the trust because of the matters that I just pointed out. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cotton. Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.